Hey guys, welcome to the show. 888-659-3727 is usually the toll-free number, but it looks like my phones are not powering up tonight. So
no power to them?
There's an issue with the power to one of my Vonage boxes, and I cannot seem to happen once before. I had to order a new box. So it looks like our live show is live, but it's going to be with me and Joe Tillman.
It's definitely live.
It is live. What's happening, Joe? How are you?
I'm good. I'm good. How are you?
I can't complain, man. The new setup looks crystal.
Thank you.
You look really good.
Thank you
very
much.
And the sound is good, too.
You know what? I owe that to you because you recommended this fantastic microphone back in the day. What was it? About it was almost 2 years ago you first told me about this microphone.
I can't believe it. Time really flies.
That's wild. But
So, guys. I don't know what's going to happen with the phones. You know, when I go to a break, we'll see if we can fix them. Write down the number. It's 888-659-3727. You can see it on your screen. And if we can't take calls, then Joe and I are just going to bullshit for a while, talk about what we wanted to talk about, and hope for the best.
That's all we can do.
What are we going to do? Guys, listen, if you're new to the broadcast, don't know who I am, why I'm here, or why Joe Tillman is here, we're both hair loss sufferers, guys who have been dealing with hair loss. I've been dealing with hair loss since around the age of 21. I am now 50 years old. So for more than half my life, I have been a hair loss sufferer. Unfortunately, hair loss affects 2/3 of men by the age of 35. 40% of hair loss sufferers are actually women. So it's a huge silent epidemic amongst women. And, you know, it's really little understood or, frankly, discussed topic in our society. Society doesn't really allow guys to talk about this issue and be open about it and feel comfortable about it and just be honest about it. For some reason, it's like the last bastion of political incorrectness, and society seems fine with that. So that's really the reason why this program was created. And when I first got on the air back in 1998, it was unheard of to discuss hair loss as openly and to discuss the reality of the hair loss industry the way that we do it here on The Bald Truth. And Joe Tillman, if you guys don't know who he is, he's actually the guy who was the first guy ever to document his hair transplant journey online with photographs, with detailed descriptions of every goddamn thing he went through. And that's why he's known as the original hair transplant mentor. And Joe, sometimes you don't get your props, sometimes you do, but you definitely deserve a lot of respect for really, in my view, leading the way as far as patient documentation online. You've also created some monsters.
Thank you.
I will say that.
Yeah.
It's just the way that it is.
It's just the way, yeah, there's always the good with the bad and the bad with the good. So, it's interesting. I think about that sometimes about my own journey. And I've said this through the years, I still have to look at my own website to remind myself of what I went through. Because when I think about it without being in front of my photos and having things to remind me visibly or visually what I went through, it does, at this point, almost 15 years later, seem like a different life.
Oh, I'm sure.
And it's
You were a bald guy with bad plugs at the age of like 25.
Yeah.
I mean,
on up to the age of 31.
You were that dude. You had to live that life. You had to figure out a way to, however you got past it, and you got married and you did all kinds of things, you know, had like a relatively normal life.
I tried my best, but suffered in silence, my friend.
Yeah, but walking around basically made to look like a man-made freak.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that you did, but
no,
that's what,
I am.
but that's what most guys who especially dealt with mini and micros, and then before that, you know, older plugs back in the day. So you speak from an incredible breadth and wealth of experience from that end of things. And also the fact that, you know, you've been in the industry, in the trenches, working for a very well-known clinic, two well-known clinics, mm-hmm. for many years, for well over a decade. So that's why I think you're such an important addition to add, you know, your perspective to this broadcast.
Well, thank you. And, you know, it's that experience in the basically that experience in the OR that I've built up over the years, and seeing, you know, what real hair transplant surgery is supposed to be like. And, you know, I don't talk about this much, but I do have medical experience before I got involved as a hair transplant consultant, because I worked in as a physical therapy tech years ago.
Wow.
In a burn unit at a hospital back in Tennessee, and I was dealing with I was in a situation where I had to deal with very delicate situations with burn patients. And when you're around burn patients, they are highly susceptible to infection. You know, their body is so compromised as it is that, you know, and there's so many issues with the skin tissue that even the slightest bacterium that can get in can wreak havoc.
Sure.
And so there are very specific protocols that you have to follow.
Oh, with that said, before you finish your thought, what a lot of people don't know about me and about my background is that I was a medical administrator for a national HMO. And I ran two offices that were huge in New York City. And this was I got this job as a very young person. I actually had to fudge my resume a little bit to kind of get in the door, because as all of you guys know, I dropped out of college.
As we both did.
Yeah. Yeah, and basically I didn't say when I graduated. I just basically said, you know, what I went to school for and what school I went to. And
you weren't lying.
No, I wasn't.
You weren't.
I wasn't.
Completely honest about that.
But I ended up getting the job, and I learned a lot about the reality of what happens behind the scenes in these big medical facilities. And we dealt with a lot of patients. While there was no surgery being conducted, there were some pretty invasive exams that were being done in the facilities.
Right.
And, you know, proper hygienic and proper, protocol as far as, you know, keeping the theaters clean, even though they're not operating, keeping the exam rooms clean, using the right, you know, type of autoclave, making sure that that's in working order, making sure that physicians are wearing gloves. In certain cases, physicians and physicians' assistants are wearing masks. And we had to make sure that all that was done. And there was no surgery being performed in this facility or either facility.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, in non-surgical facilities, you still have to follow these protocols, and there's a certain way you got to follow. Like when you're wearing gloves, latex gloves, in any health-related area, there's a certain way you have to take them off. Right, you don't just take one off and throw it away, and take off and throw it away. You have to literally take one off and then the other one inside
it. Exactly.
Right? Yeah. You know what I'm talking about. So the very specific ways that you have to do things, even if you might have the right equipment, it's worthless if you're not using it properly.
Right.
And so, you know, that's kind of one thing I that we wanted to talk about was how this translates into the world of surgical hair restoration. And you know, I think it's fair to say that starting out, you got to understand that hair transplant surgery is actual surgery. Now, you know, there are various opinions on the severity of what surgery means. When you're dealing with FUS, follicular unit strip surgery, obviously it's more invasive than compared to, say, follicular unit extraction. But when you do a comparison of, like say, if you have two heads, they're going through a procedure, and you take out a 1.5 wide strip by a centimeter wide strip by say 20 centimeters long, and then you have a procedure where 3,000 follicular units are being extracted with a 0.8 or 0.9 millimeter punch. Both scenarios represent a massive amount of open and exposed tissue to air.
Of course.
And so the chances of infection
And any airborne virus or bacterium or anything that's out. You know, people think that, you know, you're not, because you're not entering the body, you're not entering the body cavity, that somehow the, you know, the what's the word I'm looking for? Somehow the, you know, basic sanitary environment and sterile environment really doesn't have to be as stringent.
The standards
don't have to be as high. But exactly. They actually have to be as high, and in some cases, depending on the procedure, even, I think, higher.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I assumed that all clinics would approach this type of procedure, be it strip or be it FUE, with the type of attitude that, hey, you know, the mantra of or the credo of do no harm applies to how we do the surgery, not just, you know, the tools and techniques, but also how we approach it from a safety point of view, like as far as infectious disease control.
Right.
And, you know, well, I'll just say it. I'm shocked. I was shocked to find out that this is not the case. And in my travels and in my interviews and talking to patients and talking to clinics that want to work with me, you know, I have a list of questions I ask them. I've been surprised about some of the answers I've received. Some of the things I've seen when I've been in my travels, you know, I don't always talk about where I'm going or who I'm visiting. Right. There are several that I just haven't talked about. And I've noticed that these standards that we're assuming to be in place simply don't exist in some of these environments, and it's mind blowing to me. And I think it's such an issue. No one talks about this, but I think it's such an issue that patients need to be aware going in of what they're potentially opening themselves up to when it comes to infection. Infection in standard hospitals, well, like when you're in a real OR, having a real surgery for lack of a better, say heart surgery, right, say brain surgery, I mean, anything like that, there's actually a surprising number of infections that happen in those types of environments.
And those are
actual sterile environments.
You're dealing with incredibly stringent guidelines for disinfection and sterilization when you're dealing in a hospital environment.
Yeah.
You know, and I say this to my doctors, and I say it to my doctors, the doctors who are part of what we do. You know, I really try to do my due diligence to ensure that whoever walks through that door is walking into the safest environment. But the truth is, I am not there for every surgery.
Yeah.
There are things that are completely out of my control. And if for some reason a physician decides not to wear his mask that day, or if an assistant decides not to wear gloves or a mask that day, or if someone decides to perform surgery without their shoes on, that is the type of information that is very difficult for me to find out about unless a patient takes the time to complain.
Exactly.
So that's why I think it's really important that we talk about this, so that when patients go in, they know and they have a list of questions to ask, and they fully understand what the real ramifications can be if the environment is not completely disinfected, and if real sterilization protocol isn't used, and if these physicians aren't wearing the right materials, the right masks, and scrubs and gloves, and their assistants.
And using them properly.
I mean, what could happen to a person?
What can happen? I mean,
I'm saying, you know, people have to know what can happen. We're talking about major infections. We're talking about the possibility of MRSA. We're talking
superbugs.
Superbugs. Sure. From a hair transplant.
Yeah.
And this has happened.
The thing is that, you know, I think it's important for patients to understand not just what's possible, but also to understand the questions that they have every right and, I think, actually a duty to ask.
And while you explain this to people, I'm going to put the camera on you. I'm going to see if I could switch power cords on my phone system to see if at least we can get, you know, three or four lines working.
I get to carry the show. Right?
Carry the show. Only for about 30 seconds.
Damn it. All right.
It's on you.
But no, I mean, it's something that I think it's the duty of every patient that's going into surgery to arm themselves with a list of questions when they go in, and it's incumbent upon them to ask these questions to ensure that they're protecting themselves. But also, if they find something that that they're not sure about. I think it's I think there's nothing wrong with even contacting American Airlines Association to ask if something that they've seen is acceptable, or if it's normal, or if it's something that they should be concerned about. And you know, this is something that it's been important to me for quite a while. But as I've been expanding my knowledge and my understanding of how multiple clinics around the world are carrying out their procedures, I'm becoming more and more concerned about the fact that there are some clinics out there that just are not performing up to not just what I feel a standard should be, but what their local governing bodies thinks that the standard should be.
Well, you know, it's interesting.
That's dangerous.
But even some of the local governing bodies will say in certain areas, you know, in this country that, you know, say, for instance, in this type of a outpatient procedure, that wearing a surgical mask is not important, or it's not necessary. It's not something that they're going to be fined for. So
right.
People make the choice not to wear that mask based on the fact that they're within these legal parameters. But that's insanity to me.
It's insanity. But let me tell you my feelings on this. I mean, besides it being insanity, I think that, you know, there are doctors out there that will actually defend the lack of surgical masks in their operating environment. And they'll say, oh, well, you know, such and such organization doesn't require it. And I imagine that, you know, there are studies that have been conducted, and they haven't taken into account the fact that what if a doctor is sick? What if he's got some sort of chronic sinus infection? What if
sometimes I choke on my own spit and all of a sudden I just start coughing.
Yeah. Yeah. Everyone does that.
Yeah.
Or sneeze unexpectedly, like suddenly something, you know, gets up, you know, and you can't fight it and you suddenly sneeze.
Right.
What's going to happen to that, you know, to the several square inches of open wound that's right below the surgeon's face?
Sure.
Suddenly receiving a mouthful of whatever you're spraying out.
Also, what happens if the physician has, you know, hepatitis B?
Exactly.
Or has any type of, you know, saliva, you know, transferred illness, meningitis,
anything,
you know, whatever, anything that could be, you know, go through droplets through the air. I mean, these are things that when you're considering having surgery, hair transplant surgery, most patients don't ever even think about.
No, they just assume everything is up to standards. That it's not even a conscious thought to assume anything. It's just when you walk into a clinic. It's the same thing as when you see someone in a white coat. We're trained to trust our doctors, and in our society, in Western society, the white coat symbolizes, you know, some sort of person that has trust or deserves trust.
Well, my famous My famous line that was once actually quoted in a lawsuit was, "Butchers wear white coats too."
Yeah.
And that's the truth. You know, that was something that was a line that I used, obviously, to make a very strong point back when I first started out in 1998-99. But back in that time, the consultants were wearing white coats.
Yeah.
They were wearing lab coats, you know.
It was a hell of a sales strategy.
It's a total mess. It did work. And, you know, in some places they still do that, believe it or not. But
I don't doubt it a bit.
But I do think that this is a really important topic that has never really been discussed on The Bald Truth or anywhere else online. It just doesn't. It's not talked about.
This is a first, ladies and gentlemen.
Well, and it is. But when you go to a physician's website, you know, I mean, they may say that they are accredited, you know, and they may have an accredited facility to perform, you know, surgery in, yada yada yada.
But what does that mean?
Exactly.
What does that mean? Accredited facility. By whom?
Exactly. Well, it depends.
It's like saying I'm board certified in hair transplant surgery. By who?
Yeah, that's true.
It's the same difference to me. And just because you're cleared by someone 5 years ago or 3 years ago, however often inspections go on in that state or province, what's this? You know, look, whenever someone comes in, a regulatory body to do an inspection, people lose their shit.
Right.
They shut down the clinic. They scrub from ceiling to floor, floor to ceiling, all the walls in between, for a full day, right before inspection.
Sure.
They pass with flying colors, then it's back to business as usual. Never forget that, because it's something that it's been bothering me for a while, and I think it's extremely important for people to know these things. You need to go in, you need to ask these questions about, you know, do you wear a mask? Does everyone walking into the operating environment wear a mask? How often? I was reading about this today that in a typical where was this? It was either in Canada. I think it was in Minnesota. There was a study that the traffic in and out of an OR, and this is a proper hospital OR. I forgot what kind of surgery it was. I think it was like a hip replacement. It was something less. It was like a 3-hour surgery, but the door was opened an average of 171 times.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
And what happens is that creates negative and positive airflow in and out of that OR, and outside that OR, there's all kinds of things that you don't want to be in the OR.
You know, there are certain more sophisticated ORs in certain hospitals that actually you kind of walk through it's almost like it's not an air chamber. But it's almost like, you know, you go through one door and then that stops that airflow from coming in.
Yeah.
And then you go in through this other door that has kind of like a fabric type of panels to avoid exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah.
But the vast majority of surgical facilities don't have that.
No, they don't. And, you know, one thing I liked, Dr. Lupinzula in Brussels, he has a product made by 3M. It's like a doormat, but it's a sticky mat.
Yeah,
and you know, he's one of the doctors.
So it's like those silicone rollers that just basically pick up anything in its way.
It's very similar. Yeah, it's very similar to that. This is one of the reasons why I was really happy to bring him on with one of the doctors I work with, and that he is meticulous about this kind of thing. And so what you do is like. You know, you no matter who you are, you got to put on scrubs. You got to put on something that's clean that they know is safe. The mask, the hair, everything, and including the booties. You got to put these fabric coverings over your existing shoes to prevent anything from your street shoes from getting in. But then you walk on top of the sticky mat, and it takes off additional things that's even on the booties.
Sure.
And then you get to walk through. And you can't walk through until you've actually been standing on it and stepping on it, you know, for a couple of times.
No, it's pretty intense.
It's
and some and there's doctors out there that
this is the way it should be done.
And there's doctors out there who will say that's overkill. But what's the difference? You know, you spend you know, $150 on a mat that's going to possibly save somebody's life.
Yeah.
You know.
No. You're
why the
right.
fuck? Why wouldn't you do it?
It makes no sense to me. And but I know the answer. It's called complacency.
It is.
It's called laziness. And
you know, I was able to fix the phones. So we have four lines that are working, and the lines were lit. So I'm going to take a phone call and see. Let's see who this is. Hey, you're on the air. Who's this, and where are you calling from?
Hi, Spencer. Steve Gable calling.
Hey, Dr. Gable. How are you?
Hey, Dr. Gable.
Hey, Joe. How you doing?
I'm glad you're listening, man. What's going on?
Not much. Just finished a case and calling in to say hi to you guys.
Well, hi. So we've been talking about if you're just tuning in. I don't know if that's why you called, but we're talking about sterilization and the basic protocol that needs to be used to keep people safe when they're going into the OR for surgical hair restoration.
Yes.
I mean, yes, what do you think about it? It's a real mess out there, in my view.
Oh, it is. It is a mess out there. And I was listening. I was watching the show and wanted to call in and comment about it. So, you know, the way surgical hair restoration is right now, it's considered a clean procedure, and so, you know, some people use it and go by that as just strictly a clean procedure and don't go through the rigmaroles and the stringencies of it actually an operating room.
But explain that to me. When you say it's considered a clean procedure, to me, you're either opening some guy's scalp up and then suturing it, and then you're poking thousands of holes in the guy's scalp, or you are, you know, extracting, making thousands of wounds or hundreds of, you know, at least 1,000 wounds with FUE and doing the same thing in the recipient site. How can it be a clean procedure.
No, I agree with you. And, you know, I think what you guys were saying earlier, there's with the regulations in certain states, because we're not in an operating room, you don't have to go by those statutes and go by those rules. Although some people do go out of their way to make it as close to an operating room environment as possible.
Right.
You know, there's some people who, I've been to some of the live workshops where, nobody's wearing a mask and people are using non-sterile gloves to take out the strip, to take out follicular unit extractions. I've seen it where people are not in street clothes, but all sorts of different clothes, you know, placing the grafts. And there's really no quality control. And I've actually seen
street clothes. I've seen people in jeans.
I've seen sandals.
You know, when I first got into the field, when I did my initial research and I walk into, I'm talking about some of the really, really well-known clinics, I was shocked. I mean, technicians were wearing sneakers and there was no foot covering.
Right.
You know, it was... I mean, they were dissecting grafts with no masks on.
Right.
You know, it was just a mess.
And some clinics do that. I was at a clinic recently, and they didn't cover the microscopes at all.
Oh, yeah, that's another thing. Uncovered microscopes. It's such a simple protocol.
Right.
Now, all of this is simple. And, you know, and to throw in what I've seen, I've seen a doctor without his mask, but not just without a mask, but chewing gum open mouth over a donor zone.
Right. Yep, I've seen that all. You know,
it's insane.
You both were talking about risk of infection earlier in MRSA, which is all true, because you really want to do everything you can to minimize the risk of infection. But one thing I don't think you said was what scares the heck out of me is I want to make sure that I am not having any cross contamination between one patient and another patient.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we didn't get to that point yet, but I'm sure Joe would have.
Yeah,
he's on the list.
I mean, there's been some lawsuits from. I guess there was one dentist, and I forgot where they were, but they were not doing proper sterilization.
Oh, it was HIV. It was an HIV situation.
Right. And the same thing happened in Las Vegas, but not with hair restoration or dental, but I think it was with the colonoscopy and the GI clinic. They weren't properly sterilizing some of their equipment, and hundreds of people had to be tested for HIV, hepatitis, and it was just an absolute disaster. So that's one of the things that absolutely scares me is,
you know, and I'm up for my colonoscopy. I just turned 50, and now I got to think about that.
Yeah.
Holy shit. So how do I check that out?
You know, I think like what you both were saying earlier, ask, you know, when a patient goes into a clinic, they should ask to look at the operating room and ask some very basic questions. What things does your clinic do to help prevent infection? What things do the staff do to help prevent any cross-contamination? And what do you do for sterilization? Do you treat this as just a clean procedure? Do you use sterile gowns? Do you use sterile gloves?
Yeah.
Or how do you do things? And it's going to be hard for the average patient to really know all the things that can be done. But I think those basic questions should be asked.
They should be
asked. If there's a concern.
No, you're absolutely right, and that's great. I actually have some of those questions in my hair transplant patient toolkit, which is a downloadable series of 25 questions that patients can take with them into a clinic to interview the doctor. And some of those are, what are you doing to prevent infection? What are you doing to prevent MRSA? Do you wear a mask? Things like this. And what you said, Dr. Gable, is really important in that, a lot of patients just won't really understand the dynamics of what's really involved in such a scenario to make sure that they're safe. But I think that just merely asking the questions themselves will put the doctor and the clinic on notice. Hey, this guy, he's asking some tough questions. And I think that it's the eagerness and the energy with which these questions are answered that can help to alleviate concerns that patients may have. Because if a doctor or a representative, whomever they're speaking with, is hesitant to answer these questions
or they can't answer the questions. Forget about being hesitant about asking the questions. If they can't provide an appropriate response, then you want to hightail it out of there.
Of course.
Right. You bring up a great point, because if a clinic does do the things they're supposed to do, they're going to be proud to show
they
off
they should be,
their
they should be
operatory.
Rattle it off. Exactly.
Just
without hesitation and say,
I love it when I've had several patients ask me, hey, what do you do for this? And I bring them through. And, I mean, even before they walk in, I say, you know, we have a special filtration system. We have it's called a HEPA filtration system that's in the system. And we have positive pressure that pushes everything out of the operating room. And when you walk in there, I have actually a standalone HEPA filtration system as well. So
even
before they walk in, right when I even say those things, I think the patient loses interest, because now they know I'm going to rattle off things for about an hour. And you know,
like, oh shit, what I asked this for?
Yeah, right. I mean, so at that point, I think I've showed them, even you know, within 1 minute, the quality we do. But you know, I mean, we in my clinic, I mean, we go. Maybe some people will say overboard, but I just want to do everything I can to, you know, minimize the risk of infection, minimize the risk of cross-contamination, and then no patient can come back to me and say, hey, you know, I did get an infection. You guys are so lax over there, because they know we go all out.
Well, I have to tell you this, you know, one facility that, and you know, sometimes I think, you know, Bob Bernstein doesn't get the online cred that he really should, because, you know, this guy is, you talk about a stickler. I don't know if you've ever been to his place, Doc, but it's impressive. And yeah. I'm not even talking about his new facility. I'm talking about his old facility in New Jersey back in the day. I had never seen such a clean and sterile environment for hair transplantation.
Yep.
You know, he really takes his stuff seriously. And everyone else I visited back in the day, it was nothing. You couldn't even compare it.
Right, right.
You know?
Well, basically, you know, with my background, you know, I know what is needed in the main operating rooms. And then in consultation with different people, a hair restoration surgeon can develop an operatory that has very high standards. Now, it may not meet the standards of an actual operating room, just because there's just so many things that go into that, but they can really do everything to minimize the risk of infection and to keep the patient safe. I mean, just like you said earlier, wearing masks. I mean, nobody goes into my operating rooms without a mask, and for all those reasons you said. What is if you cough? I mean, I've been in the operating room and, you know, coughed and sneezed, and you know, I always have a mask on, and you just never know when those things are going to happen.
Dude, I won't even visit anybody in the hospital unless I'm wearing a mask.
Right.
That's how paranoid I am. And you know what? I don't even think that's such a bad idea, though.
It's not.
I walk in, I bring my own mask.
Right.
You know, and I'll tell you, one of the reasons is because, you know, a little over a year ago, you know, my father passed away, and I was in hospitals a lot for like on and off. You know, at one point I was staying with him for like 5 months. I was in the hospital every day. Another point was like 4 months. And I saw what went on in these places.
Right.
And I saw how, you know, they move it one person into the room after another who has, you know, they have, you know, just multiple, you know, possible infections. And just even the way, you know, someone comes in and mops up, you don't see anybody that's, you know, wiping down the trays with alcohol or whatever that's, you know, whatever's needed not to spread, you know, your basic staph infection. And it's scary, man.
Right. And the biggest thing is hand washing. I mean, you'll see people going from room to room to room, and they never wash their hands.
Yeah.
And that's why now in hospitals you'll see the hand sanitizers hanging all over the hallway. Yeah, they're everywhere.
Oh, my hands were literally raw from using Purell. Yeah. You know?
Exactly.
Yeah. And that's my hang up. And I think it's reasonable. I really do. I think expect anybody that you're having surgery with to really have a spotless, clean environment, as clean as possible and as sterile as possible. But Joe's right. I mean, Joe, you know, you told me about a scenario that I'm pretty concerned about myself. You know, people need to wear their masks. They need to wear their shoes, you know?
Exactly. And even the clothes they wear, do they require them to keep them in the clinic, or do they wash them at home and bring them in? What's the protocol for that?
Now, that's actually interesting. So do you guys wash your stuff in the clinic?
I wash my all the scrubs I wear. I wash absolutely right in the clinic.
Some places will have like a service that comes in, takes them. Yeah, a service or do it in house or a combination of both.
The thing is, the service though. I mean, what is the service? Is it a regular laundry service? Maybe they say they're
No. You can actually get a hospital grade service. So that.
But isn't there still a chance of some sort of bizarre cross contamination if you're sending it out of house?
No, if you're going to a reputable medical grade laundry service, that's their responsibility to make sure that they clean it, you know, they clean it well enough. But then, you know, you really take it a step from there is, you know, your clothes are not sterile, so do you wear any protection, you know, do you wear a gown or anything then when you do things? And
right.
In my clinic, we're all wearing gowns all the time. So do I wear a gown 100% of the time? No, but for most of the time, we're all gowned up, all of my staff who are cutting grafts. When I'm placing grafts, when I'm certainly making the sites, I always have an extra barrier on. And in placing grafts now, I'm wearing things. So, and again, that's not the standard. I would say that's not the majority of people in the hair restoration world. But I just in my clinic, that's what we do. And
let's be honest though. You know, you have you go to these meetings, you speak to these physicians, you have behind the closed door banter with some of these guys, and obviously I do as well. The thing about me is, no one is going to tell me, no one in the IHRS or no doctors that I speak with, they're not going to tell me that they had a any type of infection. Or anyone who had to deal with an infection in their clinic, unless it gets to me first. They're not going to be open about that. But
right.
I mean, what percentage of, as far as all the hair transplants that are performed in North America, I mean, how many infections do you think are walking out of these clinics?
Well, hopefully not a large amount. I would say people, hair restoration clinics who do a decent amount of surgery, they're all going to get an infection every so often. It just happens. It's if you do enough surgery, things happen.
But I'm not even talking about the infections that could be caused after the fact. I'm not talking about the infections that can be caused to the wound and, from whatever people are doing when they leave the facility. I'm talking about the stuff that's happening in the clinic.
Right. I mean, even in the clinic, I mean, caused by whatever factor in the clinic, we're going to get infections. It just happens, but it should be a very, very low percentage. I mean, the scalp is such a vascular structure that the risk of infection is low. In the last meeting, I believe it was in San Francisco, there was a poster presentation that said that you really don't need antibiotics when you do hair restoration surgery.
You mean prophylactically?
Prophylactically, yeah. So, and some clinics
but
don't.
I don't know if I agree with that. I mean, I don't know. I would feel a little uncomfortable if I wasn't provided with antibiotics.
Yep.
I don't know. I don't know how you feel about that.
Well, no, I provide my patients with antibiotics. Absolutely. Yeah. It's not long-term. It's a short-term antibiotic just to make sure I cover any skin flora.
Yeah.
Again, you never know what happens. Mm-hmm. The scalp, you're shaving. Sometimes you're working with hair, you're working on skin, and there is a risk of skin flora infection. And I usually cover patients with Kyphalex or clindamycin or something like that if they're penallergic. But for the most part, the risk of infection with hair restoration surgery is low. And that's why what scares me more is, like I said, cross-contamination. I just want to make sure that I'm not giving my patient anything I have. I want to make sure my patient isn't getting anything another patient had. And so that's where we go all out to make sure that we provide the safest environment for the patients. And that's what, that's what the goal is safety for every hair restoration patient out there.
But how many patients do you think? I'm sorry, Joe. I'll let you finish your thought in a second. But how many patients do you really think are out there, prospective patients, who are really thinking about this? I think they just assume in most cases that unless it's a visibly dirty facility, they just assume that these places, these clinics are doing all the proper protocols to make sure that the environment is sanitized and to make sure that there's no infection spread. So no one's asking any questions. All they're asking is, what's the best price you can give me and how many grafts you can give me?
Yeah, exactly.
That's exactly it. And it's interesting. I've had some technicians who have worked with me and they know what should be done. And then, you know, if they have to move or move out of the state and work somewhere else, and they've gotten jobs with other hair restoration surgeons, and I'll get a phone call from them saying, oh, my gosh, Dr. Gable, the techs there, they have dirty gloves on, and they open all the cabinets and rifle through all the instruments and looking for things, and they don't change their gloves, and they don't take them off. And
They use them cringe. As if the gloves are to protect them.
Exactly.
Exactly.
And that's exactly – it's interesting that you say that, because there are techs who – that's the only reason they think they need to wear these gloves. They want to be protected. I have heard, and I have seen some pretty insane stuff, but I have heard – of one situation in particular where a technician was actually reeking of alcohol.
Wow. Yeah.
No gloves on, by the way, and reeking of alcohol. And you can see the guy's T-shirt kind of sticking out of the back of his thing. Just literally, the guy just looked like he rolled in from a bender.
Right, right.
You know?
I mean, the quality control in hair restoration offices starts with the physician, and they have to set the standard for the clinic, and they have to know the guidelines, or at least whatever guidelines they're going to follow, and they need to follow it, and they have to be very strict about it. Just like you said, Dr. Bernstein is a great example of that, and I could see him just running a really tight clinic.
I can see that as well, and I think that what you said is important is that, they need to follow the guidelines of their local governing body. But here's the thing is I think that a lot of these clinics, especially I just think that a lot of these clinics are actually trying to get away with the bare minimum. And that's where I have a problem, because I know that in some areas a mask is not required, but we all agree, and you know, for obvious reasons, that it should be required for at least the involuntary actions of a cough or a sneeze or anything else that can spread you know, saliva and things from the mouth.
But do you think it's just it's out of pure laziness or apathy, or do you think that there's a cost consideration? Because it can't cost that much money to make things right.
You know, for me, you can't look at the cost. I mean, you just have to do what's right for the patient. And I don't know if other hair restoration – you know, I know some good hair restoration physicians that don't follow some of these things we've been talking about. And maybe it is just because their local governing body doesn't require it. Or because hair is really a clean procedure, it's not a sterile procedure, that they don't do it.
You know, I had a guy that actually contacted us. I didn't tell you this story, Jeff. Contacted us through the American Hair Loss Association the other day and said that he couldn't stand sitting in the chair because this particular physician was doing a lot of the work, because he reeked like cigarettes. And every 20 minutes, this doctor would go out and have a cigarette and then come back.
Wow. Yeah.
So, I mean, think about that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That does not give the patient too much confidence.
No, this guy's actually freaking out. And luckily, he wasn't an IHRS member. But we get complaints from, you know, doctors from all over the world, from patients who have had procedures from all over the world. And not that it's comical, because, you know, it's actually probably, you know, I don't know how what protocol this guy took as far as when he came back into the OR. You know, did he wash down completely? What's the situation? But just having to deal with that, you're right. It doesn't give anybody that much confidence. And the fact that a physician, being a physician, you know, would be smoking in this day and age, to me says that he might be a little bit lax with a lot of other things in his life.
Right, right. You can infer that. So, and I'm not here, you know, I'm not here to set the standard for hair restoration clinics.
Why not?
I am.
Yeah, that's why we're all here, man.
You know, I mean,
we're trying,
right? You're trying, exactly. Maybe there should be some standards that need to be followed, but at least I think if you go to a reputable clinic, ask those questions, ask what they do, and if a clinic is doing the right things, they'll be really proud to show off the work and to go through all the different things you do. And it really, like I said, it starts at the top with the physician and educating the staff. And goes down from there, and really following those procedures and protocols. In my clinic, we have procedures and protocols for everything. I mean, from the sterilizers. I mean, there's a procedure and protocol for everything that has to be followed, and there's checklists for everything. And some clinics are going to be like that, where they are just adamant about everything, and others maybe are going to be a little more lax.
I'll tell you, I'm so OCD, I don't think I could have, you know, if I was a physician in this industry, I couldn't run a clinic. No one would work for me. That's how crazy I would be about things.
But you should, you know, you should come to my clinic. You'll see how crazy I am with this stuff. So
yeah, well, and that's I know you've kept your staff for a long time, so obviously you're not that crazy. But you're definitely someone who really cares and does the right thing. And I appreciate you taking the time to call in, because this is a topic that in the 20 years I've been doing this, really you don't see it online. You don't see anybody talking about it. And Joe and I kind of were mulling it over. I'm like, you know what? We should do this.
Yeah. Well, nobody's gonna post on the forums their infections. I mean, maybe, every so often you'll see a complication out there.
You'll see like some necrosis, but you don't really hear much about infections online.
Right, right. Yeah. And I'll tell you, I went to the last meeting. I think it was in Kuala Lumpur at the ISHRS meeting. I went to the M&M, which is the Morbidity and Mortality Conference, and that's where, for those of you who don't know, that's where physicians go and talk about things that don't go well. What went wrong? You present the patient, and then you talk about, well, how did you treat the patient, and what could you have done better? And most of the cases that were presented were about infections. It was interesting, infection after infection after infection. So it's out there. It's definitely out there, and patients just need to know that. They need to know the questions to ask, and they shouldn't feel bad about asking a clinic about what they do.
Well, and I think that's very well said, but I think the commoditization of not just this form of cosmetic surgery, but cosmetic surgery in general, has kind of, in my view, taken the medicine out of the equation and the real risks out of the equation, and just turned it into a commodity. And people want to look better. People want to, feel better about themselves, but they don't realize that every procedure runs risk. And once your skin is cut, and once you're in that environment, there are real risks of infections and other complications that just, you know, I don't know why people are so unwilling to talk about it. It's not as though I don't think it's going to hurt the industry. I don't think it's going to hurt, stop people from having procedures. So I think it's something that should definitely be talked about during every consultation. And it's something that should be, I think, highlighted as a real risk, not just something that they see in a release form before their surgery.
Well, let me ask you this. How many physicians or how many clinics actually discuss complications and risk of infection as one of the complications?
I know very few.
Yeah,
actually,
I would say I know two. Actually, I probably now three, because you just told me that you do.
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, before every surgery, of course it's on my consent form, but I have a standard. The standard line is the risk of you. Anytime you do any type of procedures, the risks are bleeding, infection, scar formation. And I go through that whole thing. And I've had a couple of patients say, well, what's the risk of infection? And
and
I go through that. It's very low and things like that. And we do everything we can to prevent it. We put you on antibiotics. We treat our procedure room as an operating room, blah, blah, blah. But, how many really go through that? And maybe if there is awareness from patients may ask the question more often.
Well, and another guy that I think should get some props for doing that I didn't mention was Dr. Paul McAndrews. I mean, this guy is unbelievable when it comes to, his facility and comes to, his consultations. He spends like an hour and a half with people.
Yeah.
He goes through everything.
Yep.
And you will never see a complaint about this guy anywhere. You know why? Because he gives full disclosure. He fully educates his patients. And God forbid, if there is a complication, they're fully aware before they go in and sign in the dotted line. I think that's really important. And I think it's going to help the clinics as well.
Yep.
Dr. Gable, let me ask you a quick question. For the people that are listening in, what can you tell them are signs to look for postoperatively that we've all seen the cases online where they're talking about, oh, I'm getting these pimples in my head, and it's just a low grade folliculitis type of scenario. But what type of indicators Can you list out just a few indicators for people to look patients to consider post-surgically?
Sure.
That may be something a bit more than a routine bit of folliculitis.
Right. I would say the most common indicator of an impending infection is redness, mm-hmm. more redness and heat, and
heat, exactly.
Just, and a little more swelling in the area. I've had patients, like I said, anybody who's done enough surgery will get an infection. It's just a matter of time. And patients in the past who have had infections, you can just tell when they come back that first day, there's more redness than normal.
A little angry.
And the tissue, yeah, it looks angry. That's exactly it. And we'll press on the tissues, and if it's a little softer than it should be, then I start thinking, gosh, does this person have more than just, you know, a couple follicles that are folliculitis? Is he developing right. more of a generalized infection in the area? Sometimes on the first day, which is very rare, but on the second day, like if I have a patient that I see on the first day and I'm a little bit worried about them, mm-hmm. I will have them come back the next day.
Right.
And then at that point, you may see actually some pus coming out of certain areas, you know, some areas. Because I'll take a forceps and just gently press around the areas. And
yeah.
if you get a little pus coming out, now you know you have a little bit more than just a generalized folliculitis. And,
right.
and then something has to be changed at that point. But
and then in the first several days, you can see, like say 2-3 days afterwards, you can see a distribution of whiteheads throughout the recipient zone, or even in some cases, the donor zone after it's closed or from FUE. And these are signs for you patients out there or aspiring patients that you need to call your doctor, that you need to call your clinic. If you are one of these patients that travels in and then leaves the next day or 2 days later. And, you know, I think that these are things that clinics should be sharing with their patients, that if you do see these indicators, call us ASAP, because, you know, in today's day where patients are traveling more and more to have their surgical hair restoration, the surgery side of things is a background to getting in and getting out. And, you know, there's so many other preparations made for the procedure that don't involve the surgery.
Well, right? And that's why I think it's important that, you know, at least within the IHRS, that, you know, if Dr. Gable is – if someone's traveling from Los Angeles to Portland to have a hair transplant with Dr. Gable, I think it's in the patient's best interest to, you know, say, okay, listen, if there's any issues whatsoever, if you have to travel back right now, here is Dr. Paul McAndrew's information, you know, and maybe give Paul a heads up that – you know, if this patient needs any help, I gave him your name
exactly.
to consider. And I think, you know, I would kind of wish that more doctors would do that. But I also sense, because I mentioned it to some guys, I also sense that some guys fear that once they meet the other doctor, that when they go in for their second procedure, they're going to end up developing this relationship with this other doctor and not come back to them. And I know that you wouldn't do anything yeah. like that, but I think that's a very real concern for some guys.
Right. I think that with Dr. Gable, he's such a likable guy. I mean, it's easy, and I'm not stroking here. It's just you're a really, really likable guy. You're great to talk to, and you obviously do fantastic work. I think that's a real concern if a patient goes to see Dr. Gable for a follow up.
Yeah,
it's like, how can you not? You know,
that's true. I guess it all depends on the results, cancer. Also. Because if it were me, I would, no matter how nice Dr. Gable is. If my first doctor gave me great results, I'm going back to him.
Absolutely. Yeah. And you know what? I have taken sutures out for many, many physicians.
Yeah.
And people have inquired. They're like, oh, gosh, maybe I should have come here. And I said, you know, I'll tell them. I said, you know what? You went to a really good clinic. There's no reason to come here. I am very happy to take your sutures out. If you have a problem, come back and see me. But you've already established a relationship there. You have a physician you trust.
Right.
Go with their plan. And one more thing about the infection. The other thing is another indicator is pain. You know, usually not in the donor area, but the recipient area. If you're kind of touching that area and it's just more painful than it should be, because usually the recipient area is not the painful one with a hair transplant.
Right.
But if the recipient area just has that just extra tenderness that's bothering them, that's another sign for the patient to think about calling their physician and letting them know that. And then one more thing to add, when I have patients that are out of town, I'll ask them on the third day or whenever they go back to send me some really good high-definition photographs yeah. of their recipient and donor area just so I can get a peek at it. Just so, you know, so I can get a look at it from afar. And if I do need to make an adjustment or have them see somebody, at least I'm following them closely, even from far away.
Well, Dr. Gabel, listen, you know, I really appreciate you taking time out of your evening to call us. You provided some incredible information. Again, this is a subject that I think needs more discussion. And hopefully yep. we can kind of do some, you know, Joe and I, and, you know, maybe if you want to be involved on video, we can do some segments. I would love to actually kind of be able to show people, you know, some of the protocols.
Sure.
And just, you know, put it out there so people can kind of get an idea of what really should be happening right. in a facility like yours.
I would be happy to do that. I mean, even just one little thing is covering the microscopes. We cover, you know, just covering the microscopes. When technicians are cutting the grafts, are they adjusting the microscopes with their dirty gloves?
Yeah.
You know, and so there's a few things we could do and make a video on to educate patients, and just some key things to help them not have any cross contamination and help prevent infection. So
I think that'd be a great idea. Maybe we can get Joe in there to make that happen, or we could also do some stuff through Skype.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, Doc. Listen, thanks a lot, guys. If you want to contact Dr. Gabel, obviously go to iahrs.org or what is it, gablehairrestoration.com?
Yeah, gablecenter.com.
Gablecenter.com. You can check him out there. Doc, I really appreciate your time, man. A lot of great information.
Oh, you're very welcome, and it was great being on the show, and thank you so much, and let's do this again.
Absolutely. Thanks again.
Thanks for calling in.
All right.
You bet. Take care.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Guys, the phone number is 888-659-3727. We have to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll take some phone calls. Joe, I got to tell you, I think this is, while there are probably some guys who are maybe snoozing because it's not the most exciting of topics, in my view, it's one of the most important things we've talked about since we started to do the show together.
I agree. And what you said is yeah, there's probably a couple of guys snoozing, but I guarantee you there are a couple of other guys out there going, shit, that's what happened to me.
Yeah. You know what? To me, screw the guys that are snoozing and are just concerned about future treatments. We're dealing with reality. We're dealing with today. We're dealing with guys who are going in to have surgery tomorrow that need to understand that they are putting themselves at risk no matter who they're going to. There's always a slim chance, not only of having a bad outcome, even if you're going to the best clinic in the world, but of contracting an infection.
Yeah,
this is very
potentially
real.
Potentially serious infection, like I said earlier, like superbugs. Right?
Yeah.
I mean, it can happen, and that's why, you know, mild infections. I mean, it happens, like Dr. Gabel said, and one thing that he was saying is it can happen from the skin flora, which is the bacteria that lives on our skin naturally.
Right.
But you know, you can pick up some nasty bugs. And that's why I think it's important. And so I'm really glad Dr. Gabel came on. I know that he's got a really high standard as far as how he operates his operation. Get it?
Yeah.
Get it?
Got
and,
it. I go even this much further. I think even when you're walking in and you're having the consultation in the physician's own office, if that place is a complete mess, to me, that's a red flag right there.
Yeah.
Because if the guy doesn't take enough pride in his own office to make sure that it's somewhat organized and there's not papers all over the place, then I'm out of there. That's just the way that I am. That's why I probably should never have any type of cosmetic surgery.
Probably a good idea. You just stay far away from an OR.
All right,
guys. You'll be fine, my friend.
Guys, we got to take a break. 888-659-3727 on the line, of course, and via Skype. Video with Joe Tillman, who is live in TBT Studios up in Vancouver, British Columbia. And by the way, dude, you are your video is looking crystal.
Good.
Really looking good. Guys, we're going to take a quick break. 888-659-3727. We do have some lines open. I was lucky enough to be able to fix four lines. So we're available if you want to give us a call. We'll be right back after this. Stay with us.
The man who's helping to make hair loss history.
They wish to cure us, but I say we are the cure.
It's Spencer David Cobrin.
I gotta tell you, man, that song makes me want to drink. That's all I'm saying.
Anything with Stevie. Stevie was the man. He's one of my favorite performers in any genre.
But it makes me just want to go to a bar and just sit down, belly up, and, you know, drink some whiskey.
Let's do that.
All right. I'm on the wagon, man. I really got to lose this last 10 pounds, and I know that if I just stay away from booze for like 2 weeks, it'll happen.
Just, 2 weeks.
That's all I need. Just 2 weeks, and it will happen. Because what happens is when I drink, even if it's just wine, I end up, you know, just wanting to eat. You know?
See, I don't do that.
It increases my appetite significantly.
I don't have that issue. I just I'll have a couple glasses of wine, and it doesn't change my appetite in the least. If anything, I don't want to eat anything.
I'm down to like 195. I would like to get to a record weight for my age at this point in my life of 185. And that's all I need. That's all. My problem is I'll go right back to drinking and then eating again.
But you can say you got there.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing. When I drink, even the next day, like I'm not even hungover, just if I have a couple of drinks, my body just craves more starches, you know, and it makes it difficult to really get to your best.
Of course.
But as you know, we all like to, at least you and I do, and Andrew, we like to drink.
Of course.
It's life.
It's fun.
It is fun.
Especially when Stevie's playing.
It's hard. You know, I always said I can't fully trust someone who doesn't drink unless they can't drink.
Yeah, there's got to be a reason.
Unless there's either they have a severe allergic issue or they were once an alcoholic or they're recovering.
Yeah.
Then I understand. But
yeah.
You know, but like, let's take
I gotta say, Dr. Gable, he kicked ass.
Oh my God. That guy is, first of all, he's really sharp. He's also, what a lot of people don't know, he's also a board certified facial plastic surgeon.
Yeah.
Facial plastic and reconstructive surgeon. So the guy, you know, has got some real chops. And I would say that he's probably one of, again, and I bring up Paul McAndrews and even Bob Bernstein, who's just so famous and well known. He's probably one of the guys that really, I don't think, gets his props online the way that he should.
I agree.
It's actually kind of nutty when you think about these guys who make these short lists, and if a guy like Gable or Bernstein, or in my view, even though everyone says he's really conservative, McAndrews, if they're not part of the short list, they're not, in my view, they're not doing their true due diligence and all of their research. They're just
agree with that.
They're looking purely for numbers and they're looking purely for price. Yeah. And they're looking for the online celebrities who have taken the time and have been smart enough to post, you know, hundreds of cases online. You know, they just have more visibility. And,
right.
And I get that, you know, I get it. But it's as a, you know, if I was a prospective patient, and to tell you the truth, I was for a very long time, you know, especially the beginning. There's no way that I wouldn't take the time to really learn about every doctor that you see, whether it's on a list or not on a list, however you choose your physician. I don't even get into the whole list thing. 888-659-3727. I will tell you, though, every time lists are mentioned online, more doctors contact us. Because they want to be like, what is this list?
Because they want to be in the list.
I want to be part of the list.
There's a list?
Yeah. I didn't know there was a list.
A list or lisp?
It's awesome. Let's take a phone call.
Let's do.
Hey, you're on the air. Who's this? Where are you calling from? Chickened out. Hey, you're on the air. Hello. Yes.
Hey. Hi, this is Kenny.
Kenny.
Hey, Kenny.
Hey, how are you?
I'm good. How are you? Everything. Where are you calling from, man?
Oh, I'm calling from New York.
Hey, what's happening?
Good. You know, I just had I was just listening in, and, you know, it's an interesting show tonight.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. Just wanted to say I was a big fan, and, you know, I wanted to thank Joe Tillman as well as you. I don't know if you remember me, Joe. I had called you, we had spoken, like, last year around, like, December. about taking finasteride?
I think I do, actually, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I'm, well, it's been like almost
a year really, now. Are you just trying to make this guy feel good? Because
I actually think
I remember him calling the show before.
I've called before as well.
Yeah.
It does ring a bell because, or back around that time, I was actually, well, yes, I won't go into details, but yes, I believe I remember Kenny. How are you?
Good. How is everything?
Very good. So what's the latest? What's going on with you?
Okay. You know, everything, is okay. Last time I had called the show, I mean, I can't believe it's almost a year already since, the last time I called.
It's been a year? I recognize your voice. That's so weird. It's been a year. It seems like you just called
yesterday. Yeah, almost.
Wow.
Yeah, almost a year. I called, the show in, I believe it was like December or like November.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was, pretty much, you know, I'm 24. I just turned 24 in August. And, I had called last year, you know, about because I had I was diagnosed with seborrheic dermatitis.
That's right. I remember your story. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. And you had told me that, you know, maybe change my diet and stuff like that. And I think it helped out a little bit.
Okay, mm-hmm. Good.
I think diet was like a big deal for me. But, you know, I noticed it had come back.
Didn't you say you're eating lots of pizza?
Yeah, I was. Yeah. Yeah,
see?
Exactly. Yeah.
Hey, all right. Okay.
You're good.
Yeah, you know, I live in New York, so it's,
of course.
It's pretty much
easy deduction, right?
Yeah, how can you not, man?
Yeah, but you know, I had changed my diet a little bit. I started eating like more like leafy green vegetables. That was something I lacked in my diet a lot, like fruits and vegetables, just like
most people
natural
do.
Stuff.
But yeah,
and you know, I did that for a while, and I had shaved my head, not like completely shaved, but like to like a 3.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And I was able to treat it a little bit better just with, like, pretty much anti-dandruff shampoos and stuff. But then I noticed it came back, and, you know, I shaved my head again, like, I don't know, a couple weeks ago. But
Did you do anything different? Did you change your diet? Did you start incorporating some of the shitty food again or eating less of the good food?
Well, no, it is. I noticed, I was working, and I worked, like, pretty long hours, so I kind of cheated a little bit with my diet where I did start eating like shittier food just because
it's available. This is America, man.
That's
what you do.
Yeah, exactly. But you know, I mean, I've been on finasteride now for almost a year. I guess like January would make it a year. I take it every day. Well, it's actually Propecia, I should say. I'm on the 1 milligram
right.
Tablet.
And how are you doing on it?
I'm fine. You know, everything seems to be okay.
Good.
I don't know if I'm like getting any results from it. I mean, some days I wake up and I'm like, oh, you know, my hair looks a little bit thicker. And then some days it looks the same as it was before I got on it.
Well, that's actually a key, what you just said. That's very it's an important point that it looks the same. That you know, you haven't progressed in a year. Which is, I think, you know, pretty powerful. And I think that, I mean, I don't know how fast you're progressing, but that's really the key to taking this drug, if you decide to take it, is slowing or stopping the progression.
Right, yeah. And, you know, I mean, my hair loss, I don't know if you remember, but like last year I had said, like, nobody in my family really has male pattern baldness, at least not in my immediate family.
Right.
But, you know, my pattern was like, I'm kind of like a Norwood 2 with like some temporal recession.
Right.
But, you know, I'd spoken to Joe. I mean, Joe was great. I mean, he gave me like an hour of his time. You know, very.
Hey, Joe's
very
the fucking man. People,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
When people give Joe shit online or wherever, I think to myself, God, you guys have no idea how much this guy puts himself out. I'm not going to pat myself on the back because I've been doing that for years as far as putting myself out and spending time, you know, speaking to guys on the phone. But, I mean, Joe's another guy. And it just bugs me, Joe. I had to say it. It bugs me when people give you crap because you really help a lot of people.
Thank you. But it's also because I'm unemployed and I have nothing better to do. But, you know, just kidding. Just kidding. No, I love doing it. I do.
yeah, no, I mean, it was great. And, you know, Spencer, I thank you as well, because I wouldn't have found Joe unless I saw your show. I mean, this is when you guys are starting to work together.
That's what I keep telling him, and that's why he's got to start paying me.
Yeah. I keep getting these invoices from Paul Truth. I don't know what's going on with that.
But your situation now, you kind of started to – you noticed that you started to get the dermatitis a little bit coming back and
– Yeah, I mean, it's like – it's a pretty much a mild form. It's not – thank God, you know, knock on wood. It's not like – it's not aggressive or anything.
And so you're not scaling. It's just kind of red and inflamed.
Itchy.
It's not even like really red. It's just – it's a slight scaling. It's more of like a little bit worse than like regular dandruff.
Okay. All right.
But it's not as bad as it was last year. You know, it's not. But, you know, I mean, I've been on Propecia now for a year, almost a year already. Like I said, it's been okay so far. You know, I don't have any problems with that. But, you know, Joe actually told me about, like, any potential side effects, you know, things like that. Like, he really walked me through, like, what are the possibilities and, like, like the negatives outweigh the positives, and you know it's kind of like up to me to decide if I want to do it or not. But you know, I took the plunge and I did it. You know, and I've been okay so far. You know,
well, I'm glad to hear that. I'm glad that you're doing okay. And
you know,
it's
interesting. Sorry to cut you off, but okay. I want to get this in. Is you know when I was in Chicago earlier this month for the 2015 ISHRS conference. It was a week, almost a full week, of nutritional debauchery.
Oh yeah, sure.
Because you know they got the. I mean, I contacted you a couple of times. Like I was at a blues bar and I'm eating hot wings.
Oh yeah, and you're loaded too. I mean,
I'm loaded.
Dude,
and, you know,
let me tell you something.
Having you know all this different kinds of food.
A lot of crazy stuff happens in these conferences.
They do.
Yeah.
But the thing that I noticed is by day five. I was there for a total of 6 nights, 7 days. But by day five, my scalp started to get a little questionable as far as I was getting some flakes.
Yeah. And you were probably like a bloated mess.
Oh, I looked like hell. You look at some pictures, it's like, what the hell's wrong with Tillman?
Like you see your face growing as the days go by.
Of course.
I'm the same way, dude.
But no, I mean, this is – I continuously see – scenarios that I put myself in for better or for worse that reinforce my observations from I believe it's now 46 next week. So for the past 4 years that I've really been making these observations that nutrition does take a big toll on the scalp and can certainly influence conditions like Kenny was talking about, conditions like my scalp has.
Right.
And keeping it under control, I'm convinced that it's some sort of relation to sugar.
Oh, there's no doubt in my mind.
Yeah.
And that sugar plays a major role in a lot of inflammatory issues and a lot of dermatological issues. And
right.
where do you get sugar? You know, sugar's converted, you know, when you're eating, refined carbohydrates, pizza, yeah. All that shit. I mean, you mix that with really acidic foods. You got problems.
All hell breaks loose.
All hell breaks loose. And believe me, I know I'm a guy that, you know, you can watch me on video throughout the years. Like one day and it's not even that I'm gaining or losing that much weight. It could just be like from one day to the next, I look normal and then the next day I'm a bloated fuck. And it's just from like my eyes are half shut. You know, it's just from having a couple of drinks and like going out and having some pizza or something.
Yeah.
And people don't see that. You know, I see that because I'm watching myself. You know, I see my –
Of course.
I'm editing video. But
and you're a bit more hypersensitive about your appearance than everyone else is, of course. But
well, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you see these things.
I see these things, you know. I don't know what you're saying, but I'll take that as a – I won't take that as an insult. But with that said, other people don't see these things in themselves. And I watch people I know. I'm like, oh, he's got a bloated – it's a bloated day. Like Zarian. I changed Zarian's life. You know, if you look at his images, if videos a year and a half ago, he was becoming this young, bloated kid. He's a really good-looking dude. So there's no doubt. I mean, diet plays a role in just about every aspect of your health, obviously. So there's no doubt that I believe that possibly cheating on your diet or just not being as diligent probably did kind of like start this process off again for you.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And another thing is like I started like from what I've read, like with my own research, because I've gone to the dermatologist. He says, yes, you have it, but it's like a pretty mild form of it. But, you know, he gave me a topical cortical steroid. Yeah, but that was like a year ago. But I just pretty much, I used like anti-dandruff shampoo and it kind of went away. And then it came back this year, but not as aggressive or as bad as it was last year. But, I read that it's caused like, something with the large intestine where you can get like a yeast infection in your intestine from eating bad food. And this is what causes it.
Well, candida is a major cause of issues like that, sure.
Yeah, so I through my own research, I bought like a probiotic and like fish oil tablets because I hear that those two work in suppressing any of the yeast in your large intestine with like good bacteria, you know?
Yeah, and I've heard the same thing. I think the key is... if you can really get to the point where you're just eating as clean as possible and you're introducing good bacteria through, cultured foods, certain types of yogurt, most types of yogurt, and other cultured foods, then there's a good chance that it will probably resolve. And again, I'm not a physician. You'll probably start to see things resolve on their own, even without taking supplements. But I don't think there's any. I don't think the supplements are going to hurt you. But
yeah, sorry. Go on.
No. Go ahead.
Oh yeah, no. I mean, this is something I just started doing. Because I did have some stomach issues, and I felt like it might be related to that, just because I was eating really crappy food. You get bloated whenever you eat food. Like I kind of felt that.
Well, it depends on the food, but yeah, I mean. Like I'm probably going to go out tonight, and I am going to have a big ass steak. Now, if I just stuck to the steak, I'd be okay. But then when you add the crab gnocchi and whatever other crazy creamy carbohydrate filled shit that I'm going to eat, I'm going to have a little bit of a bloated day tomorrow. That's the way it is. But listen, we're actually going to – we got to close up shop early tonight. I mean, did you have anything specific? I mean, I'm glad that you're doing well now on – or at least you're not having any adverse side effects on finasteride. It seems like your hair loss has kind of stayed the same as far as the progression is concerned.
Yeah, to me it looks the same. I don't know. Maybe I'll send Joe a picture update. Everything seems to be okay.
Joe likes – he likes updates.
Knock on wood.
He likes pictures.
Oh, I do. I like to see how things have turned out. For sure.
No, I think it'd be cool. And you know what? You could talk about it on the show.
Yeah. No. I mean, everything seems been going okay so far. So I was going to call last week, but then I heard Andrew. He was going on not like a rant, but he's saying like post finasteride and everything. I felt like maybe I shouldn't give a call next week.
Well, you know what? Maybe you should have because you would have stopped him. And I actually decided to, remove. And as you know, that show is not online yet because we're still trying still trying to figure out whether or not we want Andrew to be in that fucked up position. He went off. He went crazy.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't want anybody who does suffer from side effects to feel bad. I mean, I've been lucky enough; I haven't had any.
Well, I mean, you heard me, man. I was like, dude, I cannot agree with you. I
can't get on board.
I certainly believe that the potential of these side effects are real. And for some subset of guys, they are real. They are suffering with what's now described as post-finasteride syndrome. Mm-hmm. I certainly have become a believer. I think it's more of a rare occurrence than the way that it's being presented online, but I still believe it's real. Andrew, on the other hand, made it very clear that he believes what he believes. And,
he's probably – look at your board. Make sure he's not calling to add to that right now.
Let's see. No, he's not on the line. But, yeah, I mean, I don't think that's him. I mean, there's another New York number, but it's not his. I just don't think – I don't think he understands the enormity of the situation for those who are suffering with it. And he definitely, he's a kid that speaks his mind.
Not to mention the fact that he's had an unusually strong positive reaction to the medication.
Well, he had a reaction like I did. when I was young.
It kind of makes it even more difficult for him to absorb the possibility.
People are contacting him. He sent me an email today. Great. I'm on the phone. Hold on for a second.
Oh, sure.
Unbelievable. You speak to Joe.
So anyway, Kenny, yeah, what you were saying, it makes perfect sense. I was listening to this whole thing about the nutrition thing. You're talking about, what you've been through, I'm remembering our conversation, remembering the pizza. And I remember thinking to myself, first off, I was jealous because you're eating all this great pizza. But I'm really glad you called in, because you're one of those guys that I've heard from in the past that I hope I hear what the end result is of, my advice and, the actions that you've taken. And so this is really great for me to hear that you have taken my advice, you have changed some things, and you are seeing a positive benefit to this. So for that alone, thank you for calling in.
I also like about the show still to this day, we have, with the exception of Joe from Staten Island, we have really normal guys that call the show. And Joe, I'm just busting your balls, by the way. But really normal guys who just want help and want to really get, true information. They don't have their own insane agendas, and they're just out there like, okay, all of this information seems reasonable. I'm going to make the decision on whether or not I'm going to go on Finasteride based on the information that I'm gathering here and elsewhere. Right. They know they're making their own decision. So God forbid, dude, if you had side effects, I highly doubt that you would have blamed Joe for those side effects.
No. This was something I decided to go on. It's just Joe, he told me what the possible side effects are, what are the possibilities, what I could see, what I might not be able to see. And, I also spoke to both my doctors, my dermatologist and my primary doctor. And, they were totally okay about it. I actually told them about sexual side effects. They said, it's a very small amount. You shouldn't be dealing with any of that. My dermatologist, actually, his son is on Propecia, and he's been on it for a while. And, he says his son is fine. I went up based on their opinions as well.
Well, I think the general consensus is what your physicians, described and, the advice that they gave. However, there are a lot of doctors now who are a little more conservative based on what they see happening online. And you can't blame them for that.
And out of fear of having a finger pointed at them if something does go wrong.
Yeah, I guess that's a good word, fear.
Yeah.
Right. And the one thing is with my doctors, when Joe and I had spoken, he had recommended I take Finasteride, but it's in the blue pill, 5 milligrams.
Proscar.
You cut it into four.
Proscar. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and I mentioned it to both my dermatologist and my doctor, and they wouldn't prescribe it to me. They would only prescribe me Propecia.
Well, their fear is that you might end up taking, just because they prescribe you the 5 milligram dose and you say you're going to cut in quarters, their fear is, because it's not a controlled substance, in my view, that you may end up taking the entire pill and maybe get another prescription from somebody else and just, really take a higher dosage than they're comfortable giving you. And that's just the way it is. They're covering their asses as well. And you can't blame them. Listen.
I was going to say, you can't blame them.
Yeah,
today.
Especially today. So, they're prescribing what is indicated for male pattern baldness, which is the brand name Propecia or 1 milligram Finasteride. And, honestly, if I were a physician, I would probably do the same thing.
Just covering your
right.
ass.
Covering your ass and just prescribe what's indicated.
Right, and that makes sense too. And I did think about it when they said it. I mean, it does cost me a little bit more. It's like $100 a month, but I could afford it. I work and everything, so.
Yeah, well, when I hear people complaining, not that you are, about $100 a month, I think about what they're spending in a pub or in a bar or wherever they're,
Starbucks.
Yeah. I mean, how much you're spending a month on Starbucks? Exactly.
Yeah.
You make a little bit of sacrifice, and you could spend that $100 a month and potentially If you're lucky and you have no adverse side effects, you know, and lucky enough to save your hair, you may end up saving your hair for another decade or more.
Right. Yeah. Which, you know, I do hope, you know, I did mention to Joe, like, if I could save my hair for like another like 15 or 20 years, you know, same hair density and everything, you know, that to me would be worth it, because I'm not really on board for going for like a hair transplant or anything like that, just because, you know, I'm a pretty young guy.
Why would you 24. Be if you can hang on to it?
Well, surgery's the last resort, man. That's it. You shouldn't.
Right.
These guys that come on the message forum, they're talking about surgery. They're 24 years old. It's like, Jesus Christ, man. You know, you got to get a grip and realize that as bad as this is, and it is bad, having surgery when it's not indicated or too early, because there's plenty of doctors who will perform the surgery on you, will make your life a living hell that you could never, ever imagine, especially if it doesn't go well. Or even if it does go well initially, if they are not prepared to get on finasteride, they're not prepared to potentially slow the progression of their hair loss, they're putting themselves at incredible risk of being very unhappy within a very few, you know, in a few short years.
Absolutely.
So right. I always say surgery is a last resort. And let me tell you, you say you want to save your hair for 15 years. I'm going to have hair in my head in some form or another, whether it's yakky hair or whatever, until the day that I die. That's what I've decided. And that's it. You know, whether I decide to, at some point, if I do need a hair transplant and feel that I'm the right candidate, I'll go for that. If I have glued hair pieces to my scalp before, it's not a big deal. I will go in, and if the yarmulke gets bigger, I'll put a hair yarmulke on. I don't mind that. You know, and Joe laughs. And
I think he's serious.
But I am serious.
You know, I think he's serious.
To me, it's like, and God forbid if something happens between, you know, common law and myself and, you know, we break up, the first thing I will tell a woman is, if she asks me, is, well, first of all, I can explain my hair anyway because it's so sprayed. But then I'll just say, you know what? If I'm wearing a hairpiece, it's not all mine. And that's it. See how she reacts. It's probably a little easier when you're 50 years old, though, to be able to do that or older.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I think, except I would definitely be dating someone in their 20s. Is that bad to say?
No.
It's just the truth.
Yeah.
All right, guys, listen, we got maybe the 30s. We got to close up shop. But honestly, for all you old broads out there my age, if you're really, you know, well-kept, I would definitely date a woman my
for
age.
Sure.
Sure. Well-preserved. Your name is Greg, right?
Kenny.
Oh, it's
Kenny. Your name is Kenny, right?
Yeah,
I'm going to cut that out. Your name is Kenny, right? Okay. Kenny, listen, man, thank you so much for the call. I'm glad you're doing well. And I'm glad Joe and the show was able to help you. And you should you should send him your images and we can talk about it.
Yeah, no, I'll definitely I'll email him my images for sure.
All right, man.
You still have my email address?
Yeah, I do, yep.
Okay, outstanding.
All right, man.
All right.
Listen, you take
care.
Thanks again, guys. Okay, dude. Take care.
Thanks for calling. Right.
Bye-bye. Bye.
I'm not good with the names. I remember voices and I remember scenarios and stories, but I'm not good with names. And I don't mean to make these guys feel bad.
No, I'm usually horrible with names. It's just
– So, Kenny, I apologize.
Of a different patient, actually. So, I do
– I want to call them Greg. Where did I get Greg from? Where did I get Greg from?
I have no idea. I can't help you there, man.
All right, well, listen, we're going to close up shop early tonight. I want to thank, as usual, our weekly on-air contributor, Joe Tillman, the original hair transplant mentor, for joining us tonight. You will see Joe on the program for as long as I want him on the program. How's that for honesty?
That's, you know what, it doesn't get any more honest than that.
Okay.
I like it.
No, you're doing a fantastic job, and we're getting a great response since you've joined us, so... I want to thank you for giving our viewership and our listenership your time. First of all, I mean, this guy's going to email you pictures.
Yeah,
I think that's awesome.
It is awesome. I'm glad to help.
All right, and also
I'm still glad to help these guys. So
I'll give out Joe's website as well, which is hairtransplantmentor.com. You could also find Joe participating a lot on our message forum, which is BaldTruthTalk.com. If you are considering surgery, do yourselves a favor. There's a reason why I founded the International Alliance of Hair Restoration Surgeons, and that is to provide a safe place, or the safest possible place, to start to do your research. Okay? It's not like, okay, if someone's in the IHRS, it doesn't mean you're going to automatically have a great outcome. What it means is these guys have a proven track record of providing consistent results, period. You know, they've met that criteria. But it's your job to do your due diligence and to do your individual research. Don't just read about, you know, some guy's experience online and say, hey, look at this guy. Look at those images. They look great. Because you're going to see a lot of guys in the IHRS who have tremendous images and they have a lot, they promote themselves a lot online. And you may just kind of narrow your list down to these guys. Do yourselves a favor, have as many consultations as possible, meet with and speak to actual patients who've gone through the procedure with the physicians you are considering. I can't emphasize that enough. Right, Joe?
I agree 100%. Absolutely.
All right, guys, if you want to see archives of this broadcast, theballtruth.com. Also, guysfromqueens.com. I always forget their site. It used to be gfqlive.tv or .com. Anyway, guysfromqueens.com. Right, Joe? Is that
gfqnetwork.com.
Jesus Christ. Andrew's going to kill me. If you want to see archives of this program, I'm going to cut that out. If you're going to see archives of this program, you could also go to gfqnetwork.com. And obviously, you know, if you want to download the program through iTunes, go to GFQ as well. You can download both the audio and the video. It's actually frightening when Andrew provides me with the numbers of how many people actually download the audio version of the show through iTunes. It's crazy. It's great. We've actually been on the front page a couple of times.
Really?
Which is exciting. Yeah. But anyway, guys, we're here almost every week, depending on when we feel like doing the show. But you could always contact us, and you could always obviously speak directly to Joe. Joe's answering questions on Bald Truth Talk. And you have any questions or concerns, when we're live, give us a call. Until next time, be strong, God bless, and thank you so much for listening.
Thank you very much. I'm sorry for any inconvenience you may have been put to prior to the program, and I'm glad you enjoyed it. And if you could now leave by the exits at the rear, that'd be splendid. Thank you. Good night.